And we're back with an all-new episode of Keep It. I'm Ira Madison III.
I'm executive producer Louis Vertel. I've never really had a title before. It's so shocking to have one.
Yeah, congrats.
I know.
You earned it.
Staff writer Louis Vertel, elevated. I'm so excited to talk about Coachella with you, but I have to ask, did they play Natalie Cole's cover of Pink Cadillac? Because I just heard that walking into Starbucks, and girl, that song is still fucking fire.
Who would have played that?
If you ask nicely, I don't know, there's a lot of DJs there. They can like look it up on their phone. I heard our friend Ty Sunderland was playing there. I'm sure he could put that up on his little fucking iPod or whatever he operates off of.
Ty Sunderland did play, and also Vincent came out to sing Higher during Ty's DJ set, and it was like a remix of it where only he sings every verse, and it was amazing. I love it better than the original.
Oh, interesting. Vincent, if I want to see him, I can just go to Barry's Boot Camp down the street, so I am not super sad to have missed that. Seems like a nice guy, though.
He's like a star, you know? It's just so wild that he immediately has like all the presence and the making of like someone who like when you step on stage is just electric.
Can I tell you something? And I say this with affection to our friends over at Los Culturistas. Matt Rogers calls so many people a fucking star. It is not, the term now upsets me. And, whatever, like somebody has large enough eyes, she'll be like, that's a star. But also maybe being a star is about having large eyes. So I don't know.
Are you starting drama because we both had Michelle Yeoh on the show last week?
I do think she's a traitor. I do. That was unusual that like never happened, strangely. Like we've not had the same stuff. I don't think that's ever happened before.
And judging from the screenshot, it was the same day.
Oh, no. Oh, please. She got off the Zoom with us and rolled right along in. Yeah. She was like, oh, there was faggots one and two. Here's faggots three and four.
I actually thought that the conversations bookended each other perfectly.
Oh, okay. Good. I refuse to listen to that podcast, so I wouldn't know. But
And I also just sort of love, like, you know, there's, Wednesday is like gay podcast day. You get Los Culturistas back to back.
What else do you get on Wednesdays? Is Grey's Anatomy?
I don't listen to other podcasts.
No. I have to say, I'm always thrilled when people like come up to me and be like, oh, I listen to the podcast just in general, but also because it is hard for me to listen to people speaking without me being in the conversation. Like, you know, that meme of people like listening in on a conversation, pretending it's their best friends. I can't do that. I have to, If I hear an opinion about, throw a name out there, Eddie Redmayne. Look, I have like six jokes ready to go. Guys, he looks like Amelia Earhart. Okay. See, I'm in the conversation now where I belong.
Mm. If only he would take a flight.
Wow. A brutal take. You wish Eddie Redmayne were dead. Wow.
We don't know that bitch is dead.
Oh, that's true. Right. She could be on that island.
She could be with the Lindenberg baby.
Is that anything like the Lindenberg baby?
Yeah. The Lindenberg baby was the actual best friend of the Lindenberg baby. And he was also kidnapped, but no one talks about the Lindenberg baby being kidnapped because the Lindbergs are wealthy and white. And the Lindenberg baby was, was mixed.
Oh, I see. Oh, got it. Are you pitching to Peacock right now? What is this reboot tale?
I am. Okay. I am. Kidnapped mulatto, the Lindenberg baby.
Well, that was a real journey, and we thank you for coming to this meeting today.
But anyway, I'm going to get into a lot more of my Coachella opinions this week, and we're also going to talk a bit about Gilbert Gottfried.
Icon, legend. I was going to bring this up in the segment, but I'll just bring it up now. I think among celebrities, it's the fastest voice recognition you could ever have with a celebrity. Like in under 1 second, you would know it's Gilbert Gottfried. And I don't know that anybody would be faster.
The idea of recognizing celebrity voices is so interesting to me too, because obviously there are some like Gilberts who are iconic and right. loud. And so like immediately recognizable, right? Speaking before when you were talking about just sort of like people recognizing us from Keep It, I am always still floored when someone's like, I recognize your voice immediately.
Oh, it, right. Well, no, because they're taken to their Wednesday morning where we zap yeah. them into consciousness, which are, with our incredible opinions about whatever.
Jay I just Fonda. Will rarely hear a voice and be like, oh, I know who that is. Even like my best friend's voice.
Oh, you're right. Me too. I don't know that I would be able to place things like that immediately either, unless maybe it's a song I'm listening to. But otherwise, you're right. No, I don't think I'm that acute when it comes to that.
We also have a very exciting interview this week, and I tried to contain myself as I speak to Alexander Skarsgård about his new film, The Northman.
Guys, I was supposed to be a part of this interview, and then I had to rehearse for something at work. I fucking love Alexander Skarsgård. Did you get into passing at all? Who spent 2 seconds casting him in that? Because they were like, if you want like evil blonde guy, I mean, he does it well.
I was busy talking about him being naked in every episode of True Blood.
Oh my God. Edward R. Murrow over here. Okay.
I'm getting to the facts that people want to hear about.
Okay. No, that's what I mean. No, the Peabody is coming your way soon, I'm sure.
Anyway, I'm sure Alexander Skarsgård will talk about passing on this week's episode of Los Culturistas.
Ugh, fuck them. Fuck them. Actually, quickly, right. Speaking of Bowen Yang, did you see SNL this weekend? I was loving Lizzo's new song.
I love Lizzo's new song. I do not love whoever is dressing her right now.
Didn't love the outfit. It was a little, it reminded me of Dua Lipa's recent tour is kind of what the vibe, which is kind of appropriate given that it's a disco-fied song. And it's, you think you would hear more songs like this in the wake of Future Nostalgia, which, you know, was allegedly the beginning of a disco revival for us all. But it actually is disco sounding. Sounds a little bit like Old Luther to me. And it's called About Damn Time. Yeah, it might be my favorite.
It's very Niles Rogers.
Rogers is exactly what it sounds like.
It's yes. very, you know, Bruno Mars-y. Mm-hmm. You know, it's very like JT copying Niles Rogers. But neither of them produced it.
Weird.
So, yeah. I absolutely love the song too. And I like her outfits when she leads into camp. Like I love when like Marco Monroe from, House of Avalon was sort of like styling her. Brett Nelson was styling her. I just think that sometimes when you are dressing, you know, sort of like, bigger black women, you know, like it can veer into like drag queen territory. And, cause, you know, people just have no taste.
Sure.
I really liked, like, so much of her looks, when they're fun and campy and fashion. And the SNL office was just very weird.
And it, also she did a good job hosting too. She was, game among the recent rash of musicians who've hosted SNL. I thought she acquitted herself nicely.
Yeah. Anyway, we'll be back with more Keep It. For the team that brought you Adopt a State, Every Last Vote, and oh yeah, some pretty massive victories in 2018 and 2020, Vote Save America is launching their biggest volunteer program yet, Midterm Madness.
To meet the scale of the challenges in 2022, they've divided the country into four teams, East, South, West, and Midwest. Each team has 1 to 2 battleground Senate races, 1 to 2 battleground gubernatorial races, and dozens of competitive House seats, state legislative races, municipal elections, school boards, etc.
In 2020, the Vote Save America volunteer community and the Adopt a State program helped make over 9 million calls and send over 6 million texts to voters in battleground states and helped make the difference in Arizona, Georgia, Michigan, Pennsylvania, and my home state of Wisconsin. This year, Wisconsin is probably Democrats' best Senate pickup opportunity thanks to incumbent Republican Ron Johnson, who said that climate change is bullshit, Obamacare is the single greatest threat to freedom in my lifetime, and that the J6 attackers truly respect law enforcement. And those probably don't even crack the top 10 of the craziest things that have come out of his mouth.
That was so inspiring. The Midwest also has 25 competitive House seats, including several in my home state of Illinois. That's my Leslie Ann Warren and Victor Victoria impression. And dozens of battleground state legislative seats. Midwesterners in some states will also be voting directly for progressive policy. Illinoisians will see a measure on their ballot to codify the right to collective bargaining. Ballot measures have historically been extremely successful at advancing progressive policies, even when Democrats elsewhere on the ballot face a tough national environment. So head to votesaveamerica.com/midterms to learn more about the regions, what's at stake in 2022, and sign up to get involved right away.
All right, well, we're back. More Keep It. Week one of Coachella was over the weekend, headlined allegedly by Harry Styles, Billie Eilish, Swedish House Mafia with The Weeknd, and you know, I went.
I would say you're our entrenched reporter. Thank God we sent you out there with your lanyard.
Yes, me and James Charles running around the desert.
Oh, was he there?
Of course he was there.
Well, here's the thing about James Charles. I'm never curious where James Charles is, so I have no way of knowing where James Charles would be.
That's tea, actually. You know what? There were a lot of celebs moseying about. I am upset to know that Charlie Puth was just wandering around and I did not run into him.
Now, he was not performing at Coachella.
He wasn't performing, no.
Wow. And so I'm sure he was wearing one of his bucket hats, like the other 10,000 attendees there. Like Henry Fonda and on Golden Pond.
Chalamet was there.
He was? God, pain.
Yeah. A friend of mine, alleges that they saw Margot Robbie, but, the story is very murky and they were on drugs.
And also Margot Robbie kind of looks like everybody. So you never
know. Yes. But she has been to Coachella before.
Okay. All right. So it's possible.
Yeah. So let's get into this program, which
I assume this means you watched a ton of music, actually. Like you.
I watched a shit ton of music.
Yeah, uh-huh.
I mean, that's sort of why I always love going. I'm not one of the, influencers who goes just to the parties in the desert. There are parties that happened in the desert, but Coachella is in Indio. And then the parties are usually in like Palm Springs, which are parties that are like an hour away from the actual festival. So if you want to go, you're going to be sacrificing seeing something else, or you're going to be stuck in traffic all day. So, a lot of people show up to just go to the parties and not actually go to the festival.
No, I want to say that the party aspect sounds attractive to me, but I enjoy off-season Palm Springs so much more. Like I love the luxuriating in a mid-century, you know, you want to feel like the cast of Bewitched was recently just hanging out around you. That's what I love about Palm Springs. Not like we're all dressed like we're in a Kesha video and everybody's 23.
Well, I mean, speaking of, there was a Rhonda the weekend of Coachella.
Oh, Rhonda is a big gay party here in LA, which it feels like we have the same. There's like four branded gay parties in LA and there's one of them every weekend. So if you have quote unquote FOMO for one, it's ridiculous because a synonymous party is going to be the next weekend. Anyway, Rhonda is one of them.
But yeah, but this one was for Palm Springs attendees. And then of course a bunch of people drove down from LA just to go to it.
Okay, great. So they weren't interested in the artistry of Swedish House Mafia. So they're dead to us. Yeah.
Gays are the sisterhood of traveling parties. Yeah. So, but if we get into just sort of what I saw, let's first talk about the headliners.
Okay.
Harry Styles, Billie Eilish weren't giving. They weren't giving. I mean, Billie did her thing and people are divided on whether or not, she was it. You know, the stands really loved her. I've seen her before and I thought her previous Coachella set, which had some kinks in it, was slightly better for me. It was weird too because she ended her set with, just shouting out to the audience, "Thank you, sorry I'm not Beyonce." And it's like,
whoa.
Okay, girl, I'm like over this self-deprecating thing.
Also, by the way, It's just like the wrong note to end a performance on. Now I'm thinking about your subconsciousness as opposed to the music. Also, it's like, girl, people are effing rolling. Just go with it. Okay. People are looking at the sky. Their pupils are giant rhombuses.
Well, not her teen fans.
If teenagers make it out to Coachella, I'm thinking about the movie 13 right now. I'm turning into Holly Hunter. I'm wearing my bootcut jeans and I'm pulling my kids into juvie.
The thing about Coachella is that you go there for like, to have basically a party in the desert, you know? And then I think that when you have performances like a Harry and a Billy after that aren't really uplifting, it sort of takes you down a bit. The highlight of Billy's set for me was actually Damon Albarn showed up from Blur and the Gorillaz, and you can also hear on the live stream that happened, because Coachella is always live streamed every year as well. Phineas muttering, we're going to get sued by Taylor Swift for this.
Right, because Damon and Taylor Swift had that little back and forth when, I forget what Damon said about her that got in the LA Times.
She doesn't write her own music.
Right,
Then he said that like Phineas and Billy were like... amazing songwriters.
Right. Billy did do my favorite song of hers from the most recent album, which is Oxytocin. Though my verdict on
her, I loved it.
Yeah, that's a great song. Though my verdict on her remains that I like her music and love her. I think she's a cool, one of a kind person who actually is like, she exemplifies what people think Gen Z music and aesthetic is, while as a personality, she is not that at all. Like, she seems like motivated and fun and rad, you know, as opposed to, you know, zonked out, which I guess is what the Z stands for.
Is that what the Z stands for?
I know. I'm like Abby Hoffman defining generations over here. Yeah.
I thought it stood for Zoloft.
Yeah, right. That could be. Zonked is more general, so.
Zoloft Nation. Can't wait for the sequel to Prozac Nation. But anyway, I generally enjoyed Billy.
Okay.
But I do sort of agree that like I vibe with her as a person, more than I tend to vibe with the music. Even though I actually absolutely love this album. It sounded better on the album to me than live.
Right. Not music I would need to hear live. That's how I feel about that. Yeah.
Harry Styles was extremely disappointing. And which
that
is,
really sucks because people are so amped for him. Yeah.
People are amped for him, but it's also weird to even think about him headlining Coachella. It's always been sort of weird just because what sort of hits does he have?
Right. That Sign of the Times song, like, is he going to pull that? I mean, also, does he dip into One Direction or no?
We got That's What Makes You Beautiful and that's it.
Mm.
And I feel like, you know, sort of Beyonce, right? You know, like, she, first of all, had more albums than Harry when she hit the Coachella stage. So we're already off with the comparison. But she will dip into her Destiny's Child hits, because they're great songs and they're audience pleasing. You know, like, you'll get a Bootylicious, you'll get a Survivor. You know, like, she will amp you up with those. I mean, Harry doing That's What Makes You Beautiful is just sort of like, here's the one damn One Direction song you're going to get from me.
And also, like, one damn, like, gigantic hook you'll get from Harry Styles. Not that I don't like his solo stuff, but, like, That's What Makes You Beautiful has obviously got that supercharged radio-friendly thing. Also, you know what is the underrated One Direction song, Night Changes. That's the one I was,
I mean,
like,
Night Changes is iconic.
Yeah, I love that song.
I'm also partial to Kiss You.
Oh, yeah. Oh, I haven't heard that song in ages. Actually, I haven't heard any of their songs in ages. It's always weird. I know I've talked about this on the show. The sensation of when music is inescapable for a long time and then you don't hear it for years and years. Again, it's like if you heard Bodak Yellow right now, you'd be like, whoa, it's been 4 years since I've heard that, or however long it's been. But it used to be every song on the radio.
I mean, Honey Dijon played Bodak Yellow during her set.
Oh, really? Well, you know.
Which is fucking great.
Apparently Madonna showed up at a Honey Dijon concert over the weekend.
And in Los Angeles.
Which is down the street from where I live. So, I mean, that I need opportunities to, like, run into Madonna. I think she needs to stay, like, 25 feet away from me. But it's pretty unnerving.
It was at this club called Sound. And side note, apparently, the gays were upset with this party.
Why?
Because it was at this straight venue and you know, they love taking their shirts off to dance, especially to Honey Dijon. But I guess security was telling people to put their shirts back on.
Oh my God.
It's Madonna didn't want to see that faggotry.
You know what? If anybody has had enough of the faggotry, I think Madonna has heard of it. Guys, sit down. I don't want to see your tattoos of me. Yeah.
Anyway, Honey Dijon was fucking great. She sort of closed out the festival and was opposite, the weekend in Swedish House Mafia. I opted for that for like a fun dance party over, seeing the weekend because I've seen the weekend live before and I prefer listening to the music rather than seeing it live. Swedish House Mafia, I saw a bit of and they were fantastic.
Did you get to see Carly Rae Jepsen?
I did see Carly Rae Jepsen. Carly Rae Jepsen was fucking amazing. And so here's my thing about Harry, too.
That's exactly what I needed to hear because I've been worried for her in this new era. I wanted to know if she played any of the new
songs. No, she was amazing.
Yeah.
She was amazing. She played the new song, Written on the Wind, I believe, produced by Rostam. It's a great song and she seems like she's still the same Carly Rae Jepsen that we've always been into. And that's my thing about her and some of the other people who performed. There were plenty of performances from people who were more lively, more engaging than the headliners.
Mm.
Harry Styles was a very disappointing headliner because one, like I said, he didn't give us a moment of crowd pleasing songs with, some One Direction hits, which is like, that's the whole point of Coachella, you know? It's like a big mainstream event and it's sort of like drawing people in with your, sort of your history, you know? And Shania Twain showed up during his set, to do Man, I Feel Like a Woman and then sing the one with him. And she was the most exciting part of his set.
Oh, well, I mean, that's somebody who has headlined just fucking football stadiums. So I'm sure she was ready for that. Not that he hasn't, but like she's been doing it for 100 years. And also, you ever just listen to a Shania Twain album? The way those would be engineered were, like, she would put out one album and it was supposed to put out hits for like 7 years or something. So it's just like, it's overwhelmingly banger oriented.
And I mean, every like young straight man in the audience knew those Shania songs too.
Oh yeah.
Like those were inescapable songs when they came out.
I watched That Don't Impress Me Much video recently. And what's shocking about it, I mean, other than the leopard or cheetah outfit, whatever it is, she is really washed out in that video. It's like bright white light on her face all the time. And yet no one has ever looked better. It looks like someone took a picture poorly of somebody and yet she looks amazing.
It's a Michael Jackson video.
Yes. Right. No. You know what? Yes. Yes.
Before Harry was, I'll get back to our pop girls like Carly Rae Jepsen,
okay, good.
Kim Petras. But so before Harry, Big Sean played.
Oh, how did that
go? Big Sean was fucking fantastic.
Oh.
I'd never seen him live, but he has so many hits and he's been on so many songs that, he was able to play his features. He was able to play his songs. And friends came with me who sort of like didn't really know him, but it turns out they knew a bunch of his music because his music's inescapable too. His crowd was sort of like bigger than Harry's crowd.
Weird.
And he wasn't a headliner. He was right before him. And Megan Thee Stallion's crowd, who was the absolute fucking best of the weekend. Bigger than Billie's. And she was right before Billie. Doja Cat's crowd was fucking huge. And this year, a lot of people were talking about the fact that the acts before the headliners, who weren't granted headliner status, who were sort of like the pop and hip-hop spear, Big Sean, Doja Cat, Megan, like, were better than the headliners.
Wow. I am grateful for Megan, because not only is she a new and obviously exciting rapper, but she's committed to showmanship. You know, like, there's no... And actually, Doja Cat, too. Like, if you see them on an award show, you know, like, all right, put the snacks down. You're actually going to get a full production here.
Megan was, like, exhilarating from the moment she hit the stage. From the outfits, which unfortunately were Dolce & Gabbana, but we're going to ignore that. Dolce & Gabbana sucks because they sort of have a history of like racist, homophobic remarks and just generally being shitty people.
Yeah.
You know?
It'll be right on Instagram. You can read the remarks. And then of course they've been to jail for their like bizarre business dealings.
Yeah. they are really sort of going hard with dressing like black celebrities right now. Because, you know, black people, have generally been like shut out of the fashion industry. It is harder for black people versus white people, you know, to get, outfits, for red carpets and, you know, like, for like award shows and things. And I fully believe that they're just giving away shit to like black, stylists, so that they can dress black clients, and sort of like paper over their, shitty past and behavior.
Well,
it's like, it's very obvious. Like it's giving payola.
Right. Payola, one of the great words, and haunted Dick Clark for the rest of his career, but I'm sorry it was worth that. It's an amazing word. Okay. So Megan gave you a great,
Megan gave a great fucking show. Everyone I talked to was just sort of like, that's the best of the weekend. And Coachella can sort of be hard if you're like around a group of people in the crowd who sort of like aren't on the same level as you. But thankfully I was around people who like knew all her lyrics, were very excited to see her. Unfortunately, Doja Cat wasn't as amazing, and this is when you get into the disconnect between the streaming versus the live production. Everyone who saw Doja Cat on the stream saw a fucking amazing show. The production was too much. You know when there's like the huge screens that should be showing like what's going on stage because people in the back aren't close enough to see what's going on. At certain points she just wasn't on the screen, or there were other weird graphics going on showing like her planet, her vision. And when she was on the screen, it was like there were like 15 different Snapchat filters over her each time, so you could actually barely see her. That doesn't make a fun show.
You know what that reminds me of? Every time I hear a recap of a Super Bowl halftime show from somebody who is at the stadium, because it's built only for television and you can barely hear the people or see the entire thing. Obviously, like a stadium is gigantic, so depending on where you sit, you may see it a lot or not much at all. But I remember one friend of mine was at Madonna's, and they, which was like kind of what, which was built for television and looked generally great on TV. And he said that he felt bad for her watching in the stadium. Like no one was reacting or knowing what was happening. You know, it's just, it's oriented specifically for cameras.
Damn. So you mean people didn't even see Janet's titty in the stadium?
Maybe could have been.
They didn't even see MIA's finger.
Oh my God. Oh, that was her rogue moment, like putting up a middle finger. Am I like, what?
She was barred from coming back into the US for years.
No, it's like a middle finger. It's like, that's something, that's something Kid Rock does. I don't know. It's such a strange moment for her. Maybe Madonna told her to do it. That could have been. Anyway.
So the gay pop girls, Carly Rae, iconic.
Right.
Rina Sawayama was fucking amazing.
Friend of
I adore
it.
Her. Yes. I adore her. She is very into her emotions, and like is a very nice person.
As a German, I think that's pathetic.
Yeah. there was a moment where, she, you know, had us, try to do a, say gay chant, and I never want to do one of those in my life again.
Wow. Was she secretly Deborah Messing? Who was doing that? Patricia Arquette? Is that you?
I get the
Don't
sentiment.
Say gay really hit the 50 to 60 actress crowd hard.
Yeah. I get the sentiment, but I don't think it's helpful, and it feels weird saying it.
Right. Also, it's just like, we're just out here living being gay. I don't need to make a rally for the rest of you guys to get behind whatever the fuck it is I'm doing with my life.
No. Kim Petras started out with the entire Slut Pop EP, and that was great.
Have we had a moment to discuss the Slut Pop EP? I don't know if uniformly it's amazing, which is, feels like a read considering it's like 14 minutes, but there are some real funny songs and fucking good songs on it, namely Throat Goat, which if you're familiar with the Wikipedia of Nancy Reagan, you'll know what that's all about. And then XXX, that is the song.
Perfect.
I love that. You put that on any party, I'm having a good time.
Unfortunately, she had a lot of technical difficulties, and so
she's a lot of technical difficulties getting out of the chart, so I'm not surprised.
The second half was a bit of a was a bit of a struggle, you know, with mics and shit like that. She didn't get to do Coconuts, it was in Malibu. And cause let me tell you, the Coachella set is like, the Apollo. When your time is up, when your time is up, they pull you off
shuffle
that stage.
Along. Did she at least get to do, Heart to Break, which it truly is baffling to me that that did not chart. I mean, one of the great pop hooks of the past, however many years, 10 years, I'll say.
She did, but she did a remix of Heart to Break, and I Don't Want It At All that I was not here for.
Oh, with I Don't Want, but another.
No, like she did like two just sort of like slut pop-esque remixes.
Hmm. Give us the song. How mysterious.
Yeah. Anyway, I had a pretty good time, at Coachella. I will say that this year was, uniformly, disorganized. It was sort of like, you know, 2 years off because of the pandemic. It seemed like the traffic situation is just sort of a mess. The cell phone service situation is a mess. Like they've had 20 fucking years to figure that out, you know? And it was just felt very slapped together this year. I mean, normally they drop even the schedule of like when people are performing, like a couple of days before. They dropped it like less than 24 hours before. The actual festival happened. Like people are driving to the desert, like checking their phones, like when the fuck is the schedule dropping?
I would almost send you back for the second weekend just to round up more celebs walking around. Cause you know, like, again,
there will be none. There will be none.
You think it's a first weekend thing?
The celebs and the gays, influencers are all first weekend.
All I know is one time years ago, I went with a friend to Chateau Marmont. I forget the occasion, but that's, if you don't live in LA, that sounds like, oh, you got to go to Chateau Marmont. But no, it happens from time to time. Everybody goes there.
And they have bad salads.
Many problems. But anyway, I saw fucking Diane Keaton there once. And then it occurred to me, you know what? Diane Keaton's got to do something. So it's like when you have these opportunities where celebrities may be somewhere, you know what? You probably will see a whole bunch.
Yeah. I will also say shout out to the Avalanches, who are this Australian music duo who were fucking amazing. I wasn't expecting the live show that I got, and I thought it was great. That's sort of what I love about Coachella, when you just can sort of, you're into an artist and you go and check them out, and they sort of surprise you in ways you didn't expect. Disclosure was great as usual. Black Coffee was great.
Did you see any, did you see Danny Elfman?
I did not see Danny Elfman.
Because,
unfortunately,
whoop, apparently he was the slay. Yeah.
But I did hear him mash up, I did hear that he mashed up the Simpsons theme song with the Desert Housewives theme song.
Come on. I mean.
Which is a gay dream.
Right. Also, he could have just closed out his set by being like, and here's my wife, Bridget Fonda, and then pointed at her, and then everybody would have been screaming and crying and rolling all over again. Bridget Fonda.
Do you think that would have happened, Lewis?
If I'm running Coachella, that's in the contract. Single white faggot's gonna be drawing you up a contract.
Lastly, Maggie Rogers, great as usual. I love her new, dykey haircut.
A few people have those right now. Florence Pugh, yeah. Talking about you.
Yeah, it's like, it's giving like, 90s chic.
Oh, sure.
You know? Like the like short pixie haircut is coming back again. It's just like a wife beater.
Someone should be showing up to Coachella in Lilith Fair garb. I mean, that's just how life should be.
A Purple Disco Machine, fantastic as usual. And the City Girls. The City Girls were amazing.
Okay.
So,
good.
And I will just say that JT and Carisha are so fucking funny because they clearly, you know, like a 40-minute set for them is a lot. Just be like thrust into this without, you know, a ton of like live shows under their belt. But they're just so funny and have great personalities that like you don't mind when JT's like, you know, I'm gonna need y'all to sing this one for me because I'm tired.
Oh, you know what? We need to keep like a personality index of just new celebrities who actually have interesting personalities because it's just not a requirement anymore. We're in the Dua Lipa universe where you can just sort of fall asleep in front of us and we love it. So let's keep track, like, you know, like Doja Cat. Good. We need more of that.
Yeah. More of that, less narcelebrities.
Yes. Oh, wow. Do you write for EW? Wow.
All right. When we're back, Alexander Skarsgård joins me for a chat about The Northmen and a lot more. Our next guest you will know from True Blood, the iconic Big Little Lies, and recently in HBO's Succession, which all of you know is my favorite TV show. He's also a part of what I would call the Skarsgård dynasty and the star of the Robert Eggers' latest film, The Northmen. So please welcome to Keep It, Alexander Skarsgård. Hi.
Hey.
It's so nice to have you here.
Pleasure.
I weirdly have a, Alexander Skarsgård story that I tell people from when I worked at MTV News. And it is, it was at the MTV Movie Awards. And I think it was when you did Tarzan.
Oh yeah.
And I was at the bar trying to order a drink and there were a ton of people there. And then you showed up at the bar and the bartender immediately went to you. Because who wouldn't?
Exactly.
But then, you pointed out that I was at the bar and had him get my drink first.
I thought you'd say, I pointed out that you were at the bar and said, you're in my way. Get out of my way. Was I wearing pants?
Well, I mean, you usually don't wear pants, in anything I've seen you in, which was going to be one of my first, questions.
But that was the night that I presented an award with no pants on at the movie awards.
Yeah, you had pants at the after party.
I did. Okay, all right.
Yes, yes. Right,
so I don't have to apologize for walking up on you with no pants.
I don't think you'd have to apologize for that.
All right, good.
That brings me to this question, though, from True Blood to Tarzan to now The Northmen. You famously just have roles where you have to not be wearing anything on set constantly.
Yeah.
How have you gotten used to that?
Oh, it's not that I've gotten used to it. I demand it. It's in my contract. I refuse to work with clothes on. It's inhibiting. I need to be free. Yeah, no, you're right. There's been a couple of projects with little to no clothes on. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I mean, thinking about like True Blood in general too, you know, I feel like that was every day on set, just constantly, you know, having to either film a sex scene with someone else or, you know, sort of have to film sort of a scene where you're covered in blood and not wearing anything else. What's that like? On set, I guess, and just preparing for this is my job, and I'm also acting while doing all of this.
It was quite a graphic show. And we would kind of oscillate between killing and having sex every other day, and sometimes both simultaneously. It was so crazy and an absolute blast showing up on set. And they're like, all right, so today you're going to rip this guy's heart out and then you're going to drink out of the heart using the aorta as a straw. And then you're going to jump into this orgy over here. And I'm like, all right, okay, that's a good day's work right there. It was 7 very, very crazy but fun years.
Well, going from that, which was a violent, you know, television show, to The Northmen, which is also incredibly gory and violent, what would you say the differences were in, I guess, sort of shooting scenes like that where you're doing a lot of, you know, like stunt work or you're, you know, doing a lot of gory scenes like eating someone's heart or...
Yeah. The Northmen was definitely a more kind of extreme and immersive experience. We shot True Blood mostly on sound stages in Hollywood, and we shot it in a quite a conventional way. It wasn't a conventional show, but the way it was shot, we did have coverage, and we could chop big fight scenes and stuff and into bits and pieces, and would often have more than one camera going, so you'd have more coverage. On The Northman was shot on some very remote locations, and the way Robert Eggers, the director, the way he works is it's quite unique, especially when it comes to a big action adventure movie. It's done on film, which is quite rare these days to shoot on film, and it's done with one camera, and most of the scene are shot with just one long, it's just one long continuous shot, one take. So you don't really have the luxury of chopping it up into bits and pieces and focus on one part of the fight and then finish that, have a cappuccino, and then go on to the next. This, you basically have to do the whole thing. Which was a blessing and a curse. It demanded a lot of preparation and rehearsals in order to get that right, because some of the big set pieces are very, there are lots of components and moving pieces to make that work, and very challenging. But it was also, again, that immersive experience was exhilarating and thrilling, because again, when you're on set and the set is actually built, we're up on a mountaintop and not on the back lot or on a soundstage, and Robert is also all about authenticity and historical accuracy. So you know that you're on a live set that looks exactly like a Viking village would have 1,000 years ago. And you get to play the sequence and go through with the whole thing from the beginning to the end. So when you're in it and the adrenaline is flowing, you can actually just let go and then go till the very end, as opposed to stopping, starting, which is often the case. So definitely more challenging, but also in a way more rewarding.
Mm-hmm. In this film, you are reunited with Nicole Kidman, and you had such great scenes with her in Big Little Lies, and now you have an amazing scene with her in The Northman that I'm sure everyone's going to be talking about once the film is released. What do you like most about sharing scenes with Nicole? And what was it like being, I guess, like in this extreme environment too, as opposed to how you shot Big Little Lies?
Shooting Big Little Lies and sharing that experience with Nicole was, and is one of the highlights of my career. I had the privilege of working on such amazing material with one of the greatest actors of our time, to go into that darkness together and was extraordinary and obviously very difficult, because of the subject matter, how dark it is, and twisted. But we became very close on the set of Big Little Lies, and we formed a really strong connection and a bond. Partly because we had to, in order to go there, we really needed to take care of each other, mentally and physically. I'm so grateful that that Nicole is my partner in that, because she is absolutely extraordinary. Obviously as an actor, but also, as a human being. And again, it was, coming out of that was, it was quite a journey, and we said, that it'd be great if we could find something else to do together and be reunited. And so when the first draft of The Northman came in, there was no question about who we wanted for Queen Gudrun. So I met up with Nicole and we talked about it, and we were obviously thrilled when she said yes. And it's another very dark, very twisted. This time we're mother, son, not husband and wife, but equally dark and twisted and dysfunctional. But in that scene that you referenced, was actually our first scene together.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Nicole joined us. We had spent 2 months shooting those big set pieces, the big action scenes. So that was the first day together. And after 2 months of crawling around in the mud and with just you know, I'm bruised and bloody and in a lot of pain. It was thrilling to shoot all those action scenes, but to be in an intimate room, intimate setting with, to be reunited with Nicole, after 2 months of big action stuff and to get to work on that long, intense, dark, twisted scene, was such a treat. And again, we already had that connection, that trust, so we could, in a way, just hit the ground running, when we started working on it. And, I don't know how Nicole felt, but I was just like buzzing. I was so excited because again, it's so well written, that scene, and so surprising, and to kind of jump in and explore that together with Nicole was, one of the highlights of the entire shoot.
And I mean, obviously, you know, you've come from a, acting, family background, but you know, working with like Nicole, you've worked with like, especially to like gay movie viewers like me, you've worked with a lot of iconic actresses from like Nicole Kidman, Julianne Moore, Kirsten Dunst in Melancholia. You know, yeah. Like what's it like working with, I guess sort of like these actresses who are at the top of their game, who've been, doing this sort of forever. And what have you sort of learned from having them as scene partners?
I think all those three ladies that you mentioned are, they're up there for a reason. They are extraordinarily talented, but also, people want to work with them, not only because they're talented, but because they're also, they bring a lot of joy to a set and enthusiasm and energy. So that's, I think that's why, it's part of the reason that people just, again, keep coming back and want to work with them again and again, because they're so fantastic. And I had the privilege of working with Kirsten, not only on Melancholia, but she did a show called On Becoming a God in Central Florida. And I got to play her husband again on slightly lighter tone, more comedic than Melancholia. But again, to be reunited with Kirsten the way I was reunited with Nicole was, it's so wonderful when you've had that shared an experience, and it's so intense to then years later to be reunited on and working with someone who's at that point a dear friend, and when there's that connection and so much trust and so much joy in jumping in and starting to work together. So I've been, like you've said, I've been very fortunate in working with some of the greatest out there.
Yeah, I mean, Melancholia is truly like one of the best films of the past few years, and one of my favorite performances.
And we actually had so much fun shooting that movie. I remember that set. We shot it in southern Sweden, and we were just laughing, having a great time, like going out for dinners, drinking on weekends. And when people, I mean, the movie is about the end of the world.
It's like, yeah.
So people imagine like, and you know, it's dark and depressing, and people imagine like, oh my God, how do you guys make it through that? And I was like, we had the best time. Like, we went to a music festival in Gothenburg one weekend and living the dream. It was amazing. Maybe because we needed it, that it's the subject matter and the relationships are so dark and dysfunctional that maybe we need a bit of balance. So, but it was a really incredible experience.
Well, I mean, it's a Lars von Trier film too. And like, you'd expect like those films are dark and twisted, and you'd expect, I guess, the sort of process of making it would also sort of mirror that. I mean, what have you learned about Lars von Trier, I guess, from, your father being in so many of his films?
So Lars is diametrically opposite Robert Eggers in his style of filmmaking. And without sounding too diplomatic, I love both, and I feel very privileged to be able to go from one to the other. I just worked with Lars again, a couple of months ago. He's doing, a sequel to The Kingdom, his, a limited series that he did 25 years ago.
Oh, wow.
Rob is all about meticulously planning every shot, every detail, storyboarding it, lighting the set for hours. And it's just every shot is a Renaissance painting. Lars, you show up to a set working with Lars. We don't block scenes, not even, you don't rehearse it. You don't block it. So you show up and Lars is just like, okay, let's see what happens. And I'm like, well, should I come in through the door or am I already here? Or we'll see. Have fun. Play. Okay, go. And then the camera is, and it's all natural lights and you can move around 360. There are no, marks that you have to hit or, you just like play around with it. And, it's often completely chaotic, but somehow Lars finds something interesting in that chaos. And then, he'll pick up on it and then, you know, start to massage it and go again. And obviously he'll give notes once we start shooting, but his approach to it is very much, very free form compared to Robert.
I mean, what was shooting that limo scene like in Melancholia where, you know,
that was our very first day on set. And, speaking to like Lars's, style of filmmaking, we're in the limo and again, we don't block it. We don't rehearse it. So Lars is like, all right, you guys are sitting here. Alex, you're talking to the driver, trying to direct him and help him, on this like winding road. And maybe at some point you'll get out of step out of the limo to help him out, to direct him. And I asked, all right, Lars, which side, which door would you want me to step out? Cause I was sitting in the limo in the middle, like, you know, cause I, on a normal movie, the director would be like, oh yeah, well, I'm doing the master from over here. So it's actually good if you step out on this side, cause then I'll see you or, you know, but I'll never forget the look Lars gave me when I asked, like, so which side? And he's like, Alex, I don't know. Whatever you feel like, well, explore it. Good. I'll find you. And that kind of, I was like, all right. Okay. So this is the style of filmmaking where, you basically just do what you feel like. And then he'll come running with a camera handheld and find you. And that kind of, so that set the tone. That was no matter how complex and difficult the scene was, we had scenes with five cars pulling up and people getting out and, technically quite messy scenes and still no rehearsals. No, like it would be complete and utter chaos, but, I guess Lars finds some creativity in that chaos.
Mm-hmm. Is there anything that you feel like, you know, you've learned from, your dad, you know, like in terms of acting, in terms of just sort of like how you approach work, or do you find that you, have a completely different approach to like material than him? I mean, you've worked with him in a few things as well at this point.
First of all, he never really, I'm grateful and I appreciate that he never really tried to steer me in any direction, in terms of, career choices. Mm-hmm. When I was a child actor for a bit and when I didn't want to do that anymore when I was 13, he was super supportive. And then for 8 years, I didn't want to do any acting and then when I came back to it, I was like, when I was 20, 21, I want to try it out. He was equally supportive. So that's kind of been his approach to all of us, me and my siblings. Of he's always there if you need advice or help, but he's not going to, and obviously, try to share experiences and stuff that he's learned, throughout the years. But, he's very much, his approach has always been very hands off and explore, go have fun, do your thing. All I want is for you guys to be happy and I don't really care, how you find that happiness, what you want to do. I'm here for you. And that gave us a lot of confidence and allowed us to go out and find our own paths. And so I'm very grateful for that. And then I've always admired his approach to the industry, and to his profession. Cause it's a hybrid of, he takes his work incredibly serious, and he works super hard and is diligent and, it's always on time. He knows his shit. He's done his homework. He also doesn't take it too seriously.
Mm-hmm.
The job nor himself, and not the end of the world. And I think that's a healthy approach to it, where it's not the most important thing in the world. Like it's important, and it's a big part of who he is and what gives him joy in life, but it's not the most important thing. And I think that's quite healthy. Especially when it comes to all the chaos around, the actual work when you're on set is one thing, but there's obviously so much around it with, releasing a movie, the press junkets, the award shows, all that chaos mm-hmm. around it that, he's always had. I admire his approach to it and has a very healthy kind of distance to it where he can laugh at it and how silly it can be.
I mean, how exhausting are press junkets for you at this point? Because you do big blockbuster films, but I mean, I imagine even like you did True Blood for 7 seasons, you know, I imagine yeah. for 7 years, you're being asked the same question.
I find it. Well, first of all, it depends on the project. Like if you're, genuinely excited about a project and you love talking about it and you had an amazing experience shooting it, then, you're more incentivized to actually spend hours and hours and hours talking about it, obviously. And it also depends on the format, like doing this kind of stuff where you can have a real conversation, is lovely. Doing these. So when you do, I think, you know, some days you do 64-minute interviews with like 30-second yeah. breaks, then it doesn't really, there's no time for a conversation, or you don't even have time to ponder something because then those 4 minutes are gone. And when journalists only have one, maybe two questions, it gets a bit repetitive you don't get into a conversation that flows really because you don't really have time for that. So that can be relentless, but it's obviously part of the job, and it's a week or two, and you just get through it, of course.
Yeah. I mean, what do you find that you've preferred, you know, doing like a big action movie, or sort of doing something smaller? I will say that even when I see you in like an action movie, something that you feel like is a throwaway, like a Godzilla versus Kong, you still sort of bring, there's always something about your eyes in a film where it's like you're thinking, I don't know, sort of like this, almost like, I think Michael Keaton's another actor who I feel like has this quality of like, it's like your eyes are always looking at something that's going on in the frame or the scene, and you're thinking about what is like your brain has an internal character, and what you sort of, you don't see that in bigger action movies. It's even in Tarzan.
Thinking about laundry, like, should I do laundry? But like, did I turn off the stove? Thank you. Thank you very much. I really appreciate hearing that. It's very nice of you. It's not really about the scale of it. I think it's a boring answer, but it's ultimately about the character you're playing. Are you mm-hmm. excited to play that character? And it could be in a big $200 million monster movie or a small student film. If you're curious and, creatively excited when you read the script and feel like I want to spend a couple of months with this character. I want to learn more about him, and that is the kind of the essence of it. And then other component, obviously, who is the filmmakers? That's someone you really want to work with. Are you going to work with Nicole Kidman? Yeah, yes, of course you say yes. Then, you know, it depends on all those component. But then also the extremes are fun. And when you're thrown from, again, comparing Robert Eggers to Lars von Trier, diametrically opposite, but it is creatively inspiring when you find yourself in an environment that is very different from what you've just gone through. Those are the most fulfilling jobs where you feel like, oh, this is completely new. And that also goes for, genre, for scale, doing a tiny little indie, and then go from that to something like The Northman or Godzilla versus Kong, which is like crazy big, is a lot of fun. And if you're connecting and having a great time playing the character, it's, that is a true privilege to be able to kind of go back and forth between, different genres and a limited series to a movie, this big movie to a small movie. And, if I can keep doing that, then I'm incredibly lucky.
Yeah. I mean, Godzilla versus Kong will always have a place in my heart only because it's the first film I saw after the pandemic. It's the first film I saw in theaters.
Wow. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's like the first film where, I think I said this with a friend. It was the first film where I didn't check my phone while watching it in like 2 years. Cause when you're watching movies at home during the pandemic, like your phone's by you. Like everything's going on. It's the first time I got to sit in a movie and was like, wow, I'm actually watching a movie again.
And I think that was part of the success of the movie. It's so unapologetically big and loud and fun. And people after watching movies on their phones and iPads and computers, really craved something big and fun and visual and just turn up to 11. And, they sure got that with Godzilla versus Kong.
I mean, they get it with The Northmen too. And I can't not let you go without also asking about shooting the scene with Bjork, who's also done, iconic Lars von Trier film, Dancer in the Dark.
Yeah.
I mean, what was that scene like? Cause it's sort of what, it's what I expect. When I knew Bjork was in the film, I was like, this is exactly what she's going to deliver. It's exactly the one scene we're going to get from her.
Yeah. She did not disappoint. I think this is the first time since, Dancer in the Dark, her first movie since Dancer in the Dark. And it all came together because, Bjork actually, is a friend of Sean, who's the screenwriter who co-wrote the screenplay for The Northman together with Rob. They're old friends. They had like a punk band in Iceland in the '80s and basically grew up together. So that's how Rob and Sean were able to convince Bjork to join. And to shoot that scene was, I mean, it was incredible. I've obviously, been a massive fan of Bjork since I was a teenager, and she is just as cool and etheric as you can imagine. It's that night, and we shot it in this burnout barn, and with a massive full moon behind her. I don't even think it's in the movie; you don't see, but like in. That night, obviously it had to be a full moon when you work with Bjork. So it was just right behind her head. And that image, that visually standing there, the way she looks, you know, and I'm sure people might have seen her in the trailer like that. And with the moon in the background, it was just like, yeah, I was pinching myself. I couldn't believe my luck that I got there. It was one of those moments where I'm not sure I was very present in the scene. I kind of felt like I was watching something extraordinary. Like I was eating my popcorn and like, wow, this is great. And then I realized, oh shit, I'm on camera. You know, but what a treat.
Yeah. I mean, Bjork, Nicole Kidman. I didn't even mention Anya Taylor-Joy, who's also fucking amazing. I mean, from Eggers' first film, The Witch too, to this. So. I mean, what's it like being with Anya in scenes? I mean, what sort of intensity does she bring to a role? Is it, did you feel like you matched wavelengths? Cause I mean, she made Chess look very intense in the Queen's Gambit.
it was very helpful having, again, Rob and I had worked together for many years before we started shooting the film, but I'd never been on set with him. Anya had, so that was very good to have a fellow actor who had the experience of working with Rob, because again, it's so specific and particular. And so talking to her was great in prep of understanding a bit how, what that process would be like on set. And we also spend a lot of time talking about in the beginning of the movie, there's not that much. They don't share the screen very much in the beginning of the film, Amleth and Olga. But they obviously have this very strong, connection, and she is integral to his destiny, his fates. And, it was imperative to for the audience to feel that. So Anya and I talked a lot about, and with Rob, obviously, about how can we charge those scenes and make them, even though in the beginning there's only a few of them, we really want the audience to feel that this is an electric connection. And it's really something special, and that they feel that pull in a way. And yeah, so it was a lot of fun working with Anya and prep on that, and then shooting. She's incredibly talented, obviously, but also so sweet and humble, and just the best, most amazing team player. It was tough out there, and there were days where Anya would be deep in the background behind 200 extras on a field for a week. But she would always give 100%. Even when she wasn't on camera, but be there and be supportive and push the other actors and the extras and everyone, and just like constantly, just a source of joy and energy. And that was helped a lot when in those tough day and night shoots.
Yeah. I mean, to go from, doing basically being in the mud and dirt in The Witch to then wanting to do it again, like she must really love that.
Yeah, Rob and Anya are like, they're super tight. They really found each other on The Witch, so it's beautiful to see that creative connection and personal connection as well.
True. Yeah, I mean, I really enjoyed the film, and I feel like everyone in the film is someone I sort of really admire their work. You know, I mean, Claes Bang was in The Square, which is one of my favorite films of the past
few
years.
Oh, that's such a great film.
And it's nice seeing it's nice discovering Scandinavian cinema, I guess, as an American.
I'm happy to hear that, Ira.
Last question before I go. Other actress who I forgot to ask about you working with, you were in Gaga's music video for Paparazzi years before she was Academy Award winner, Gaga. Yeah. Do people still recognize you from that video?
I get it occasionally. Yeah. I don't even think I knew who she was at the time. I believe it was her first album, right?
Yeah, it was definitely the first album. Yeah,
it was the first album, right?
Yeah.
Well, my friend, Jonas Åkerlund, directed that video, and I think I was shooting season one of True Blood or something. Mm-hmm. It was very early days of True Blood, and he Jonas called and said, "I'm doing this music video, and this girl, Lady Gaga, and the story's like you try to kill her, and then she ends up killing you." And you're going to speak Swedish, and you want to do it. And I said, absolutely. And then we had a crazy weekend up in Malibu shooting that beautiful villa.
Well, I love you casually being friends with the director of Ray of Light, which is an iconic video as well. So,
well, he's a fellow Swede, and we tend to, it's a weird little community here in the States of Swedish people in the industry.
Yeah, I can imagine. There's not that many of
it's
you.
Like
so
a cult. Yeah.
Well, it was really nice to talk to you today, Alex.
I really enjoyed it. Yeah. Again, it's nice to have a real conversation and after 300 four-minute interviews. So it's I really, really enjoyed it.
The Northman is in theaters April 22nd. Gilbert Gottfried passed away at age 67 this weekend, and as a comedian, he was known for his crude humor and appearances on Hollywood Squares, Comedy Central roasts, and a bunch of iconic film roles, like Iago in Aladdin. A lot of people put in photos of Iago in their Instagram stories this week.
Sure. No, again, it reminds me of... You know, my favorite thing people did on Twitter, and they still do it on Robin Williams' birthday, when it's...
The photo of the genie?
The photo of the genie. Was R.I.P. genie, you're free. I'm sorry. It's so insane. I literally... I can't believe I brought it up because I'm turning red. It's so shocking. It's so insane and childish. Anyway. Yes, Gilbert Gottfried. When we were...
You know, he actually was a genie.
Oh, but I didn't know that. Well, that... Yeah. The Fisher King, you know, of Agrabah, yes.
If I were still allowed on Twitter, I would probably post something like, R.I.P. Mork, you can go back to your home planet.
More, wow. You might get that Pam Dauber retweet, you never know. No, when we were devising this episode, Ira was like, oh, you should take the lead on Gilbert Gottfried, you probably know way more about him than I do. But honestly, I think you know all the Gilbert Gottfried stuff. He was like, an SNL cast member in the early 80s for like a very brief stint during their cursed sixth season, which is when, after John Belushi and Gilda Radner left, they rolled in a new cast, had a new producer for a year. Lorne was supposed to come back the following year, and it was a massive failure. They only kept Joe Piscopo and a new young performer named Eddie Murphy the following year, and that's eventually when Eddie Murphy popped off. But Gilbert Gottfried at that time.
I love when you go into like VH1, like, oh, yeah, Behind the Music territory, and they only kept a young performer named Eddie Murphy.
You know what? Tease. I think I am utterly brainwashed by those. Like, I think that's how you're supposed to be a broadcaster. Like the E! True Hollywood story, you know? But anyway, so Gilbert Gottfried at that time didn't even use his like trademark squinting or the voice you know of him. He was actually unrecognizable in most ways. But in the years following, he obviously got the Aladdin voice role. I remember him as a kid from the cursed Problem Child movies, which...
Okay, can we talk about these movies?
Okay,
because
I'm sure you
was obsessed...
Them.
Of course. I mean, I think everyone, our specific age group, was obsessed with the Problem Child movies. And they were constantly on TV.
Yes.
I've seen Problem Child 1 and 2 more. We talked last week about how many times we'd seen, like, our favorite movies, like Bring It On, and how many times you've seen Clue. I actually would posit we've probably seen Problem Child more than those films.
No.
It was always on TV.
Unavoidable. And also, it's that part of that brand that was in vogue when Home Alone was popular, right? Like, naughty kids, you know, like tricking the adults. That was always baked into, like, all of our advertising. Like, I remember the Burger King Kids Club. That was always like, we're like rowdy and on our own and the adults can't tell us what to do. Everything about our lives was like, kids are special and like little punks, little imps.
What's weird is you might think that Gilbert Gottfried is the loudest person in the Problem Child movies, but everyone in those fucking movies is screaming.
It's like you were saying about all that, like children's entertaining is just yelling, really.
Problem Child is about John Ritter trying to raise this kid, Junior, played by Michael Oliver, who is a young terrorist.
Yeah. Right. I don't want to know what happened to him, if you know what I'm saying. I don't want to look up the January 6th record, etc.
I think that even as a kid, I was not on the Problem Child side.
Oh, wow. You were advanced.
You're
like Prison Works.
I hated this child until the sequel, Problem Child 2, where you were introduced to a female problem child who is even more evil than him.
Right. She had kind of like a haunted, like a Juliette Lewis quality. This seemed like if Juliette Lewis were four and possessed, that was her whole vibe.
The girl was named Trixie. And she was evil.
Right. No, and they were kind of adversaries at first, and then they worked together. But here was a gay thought I had as a child. I rooted for her because her mom, or not her mom. Her mom was played by Amy Yazbeck, who was in the original and, of course, was married to John Ritter for a while. I think Amy Yazbeck plays two different roles in these movies. But Junior, in the second one, his dad remarries Lorraine Newman, speaking of the original cast of SNL. And I remember fucking loving her. I was like, oh, like a sullen bitch. This I understand.
Can we get to the Wikipedia for Trixie, the girl problem child in Problem Child 2? She, her real name is Ivy Ann Schwann. Apparently her mother, Donna, was her manager during her child acting career, and was also deeply religious. So she turned down the role of Claudia in the film Interview with the Vampire. So she turned down an audition.
I see. Oh, I'm going to say, I feel like
as if she would have gotten it.
Yeah, right.
And there's like nothing with her after 2015. Her years active are listed 1989 to 2015.
Oh, okay. Well, again, so these kids would like ruin John Ritter's life. I remember a scene where they projected babysitters having sex out of the side of the house. Anyway, who is this movie for? Because you'd think it'd be for kids, but obviously kids shouldn't be seeing that either. Not to be Tipper Gore about it. But anyway, Gilbert Gottfried played the principal in these movies, and I mean, it's him screaming at you for 10 minutes. You know who is also in those movies? Jack Warden, who plays John Ritter's dad and is, you know, in like Heaven Can Wait and Shampoo, just a classically grizzled bastard actor. And I bet he's the part of those movies that holds up. But
so these films were box office successes, though.
Right. And like critically panned. Yes.
Critically panned. The first one like grossed $72 million worldwide. The second film didn't gross as much, but it beat T2 Judgment Day at the box office.
That is too bad. I mean, again, guys, historians should be tracing a lot more to this moment, you know?
Also, there was a Problem Child 3, Junior in Love, and it was a TV movie. Film.
Oh, I saw it at the time. Oh, I saw it. Yeah.
Yeah. Justin Chapman replaced Michael Oliver, and William Catt replaced John Ritter, and then everyone else returned for the film.
You said that actor's name, and I can actually picture him. I remember them replacing John Ritter, who, by the way, irreplaceable person, not just because of Three's Company. Weirdly, people don't know this. I think it's on the back of Hollywood High, right in the middle of town. I see it every day because Kimmel Studios are across from it. There is a giant mural of John Ritter there. So it's the high school where their mascot is the Sheiks, which is, you know, in tribute to Rudolph Valentino, but I'm going to say politically that probably doesn't hold up. But anyway, right there, you can see a big giant mural of John Ritter looking exactly like John Ritter.
I love that man. I love that man. That's my father.
The humanity. What did we else put? Oh, Bad Santa. That's what else we put him in.
I was raised on reruns of Three's Company. And by saying raised, I watched them myself late at night. John Ritter is just truly like my favorite adult actor as a kid.
Yeah. Oh, a genius physical comedian. And I feel that Joyce DeWitt inhabits me from time to time. I feel like I have the Joyce DeWitt energy about me.
It still holds up. It still holds up, by the way. Three's Company.
You think so?
I mean, it doesn't hold up in its sort of like weird homophobic, and sort of sexist, misogynistic jokes, but the conceit, like the comedy in it, like you will still laugh watching it.
Cause it's so broad. I mean, it's like you're watching a telenovela of a telenovela. Okay, quickly, I'm going to wrap up Gilbert Gottfried by saying he had a podcast in recent years where he evinced that he is this old Hollywood, super savant. He would like interview veteran actors and, he was, much beloved in that way. He was canceled for some tweets regarding a tsunami a few years ago, but bad jokes. He's from another era. Maybe you make bad jokes sometimes. I'm not saying he should be uncanceled. I'm saying it's notable, and I don't want that to go unnoticed.
Oh, wow. He was dismissed by Affleck because of those tweets.
Correct.
Wait, yes. He tweeted 12 jokes about the earthquake disaster in Japan.
Right.
12?
It wasn't one. It was a dozen.
She was on a roll.
He was like, I'm positive this is still great.
I mean, a lot of people will also remember him from, the Aristocrats, which, everyone was talking about in 2005 as it was the funniest thing that has ever been invented.
Well, it was, maybe we even brought this up when Bob Saget passed away, but this is a documentary where people tell the same joke, their own version of a familiar joke, which is they explain this family carnival act, and usually it's, there's a lot of lewd and ridiculous things they do, like, oh, the son is jerking off the dad who's doing whatever, whatever. And then it ends with, and what's the name of this group? And you say the Aristocrats. My favorite in that movie is Wendy Liebman, whose version of it is opposite. She describes something really benign. She's like, a family sits down to dinner. They thank each other politely. They leave the room. And then you ask, what's the name of that group? And she goes, the cocksucking motherfuckers. See, a play on a joke.
It took me a while to realize that sort of like an aristocrat was just sort of like a member of like a social class
yes.
with like inherited titles. Because I was always confused. Because of one of my favorite films as a kid was The Aristocats.
You're right. And those are fancy people, so.
Yeah. People don't talk about The Aristocats enough.
I don't even know that I've seen it.
You've never seen The Aristocats?
No, I'm getting it even mixed up with Oliver and Company in my head.
I mean, that is a Billy Joel classic.
Right, yeah. And Bette Midler? Yeah.
Yeah, his only album I like, the Oliver and Company soundtrack.
Wow, you went with the hardest take possible. I do enjoy 52nd Street, but okay.
I'm sorry, I hate Billy Joel.
Get this? I don't know that I do, other than he is the most literal songwriter of all time. If you're looking for a metaphor, you won't find it. You'll find someone just being straightforward telling you about an emotion.
Scenes in an Italian restaurant is literally about an Italian restaurant.
Right. Here's a bottle of red, a bottle of white. He's just, he's like a journalist. Yeah.
Gilbert is also like great in the Beverly Hills Cop franchise.
Mm, yes. God, I haven't seen Beverly Hills Cop in forever. Another, talk about a movie you used to see on TV all the time. Like, that's exactly the genre of movie that I haven't seen much of recently.
I mean, I feel like we could do an entire episode on movies we remember only because they were on TV all the time.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Especially on Comedy Central. Yeah. The Chase with Charlie Sheen and Christy Swanson. Why have I seen it 40 times? Anyway, something broke in me when Cloris Leachman died. It's just like, oh, I guess anybody can die. So I'm now callous, but I think it's important to take time to specifically recognize celebrities for whom there is no second one of, and Gilbert Gottfried is exactly that.
Baby, she was 94.
She should have been 115. I just saw footage yesterday of Carol Burnett, like, out in meeting somewhere. She's, like, 88 years old. She is looking spry and sharp as a tack. So, you know what? No excuse. Stay sharp, everyone.
That's Cloris Leachman's problem. She didn't stay sharp. Should have been like Carol Burnett, bitch.
That's my eulogy.
All right. Well, we're back. Keep it. And we are back with our favorite segment of the episode. It's Keep It.
Wahoo.
Lewis, what's your Keep It?
Shall I start? Okay, this is an odd Keep It for me, because I don't think the movie is entirely a thumbs down, but there are Keep Its within this film that should be acknowledged. You guys know what Aileen is, which is the new unofficial Celine Dion biopic that is French, starring an actress named Valerie Le Mercier. Ira, I'm sure you've seen the press for this.
Well, you know, when I was in Paris, the movie was everyone's lips were talking about Aileen.
Well, first of all, in Paris, they all definitely pronounce the S in Paris, so you nailed that.
Paris!
But a couple things here. It's perfectly watchable, and the actress who's playing Celine Dion in it is... exceptional. You come away from the movie being like, wow, she really inhabited not just the kind of regality of Celine Dion, but her utter French goofiness. Truly, it looks like Celine Dion is somebody who's may as well have been raised by Jerry Lewis comedy. The way she is just popping off with like, strange movements all the time. Kookiness. There's no other word for it. But here's what's going on with this movie that's strange. My keep it is to one. They are awfully forgiving of the fact that Rene Charles, who is not named Rene Charles in the movie, definitely groomed Celine Dion. I mean, when you're marrying somebody you've known since you've been managing someone who was a preteen, I mean, it should be investigated more. And obviously, her parents in the movie question it. They're like, he's a old fat guy. Why are you into him? And she basically just insists, I'm in love with him. And he is kind of following her lead, which is like a grooming tactic. Anyway, it should be investigated by somebody.
Secondly, one of the four G's.
Yes.
Grooming, girl bossing, gatekeeping, and gaslighting.
Okay, that's very funny. Secondly, this actress, Valerie Lemercier, also plays Celine Dion as a child in the film, meaning a child is on screen and her face is beamed onto her. And we see Celine, for example, auditioning for a record label with Valerie Lemercier's, you know, middle-aged face on this girl. In one of the reviews, our friend Kyle Buchanan, who co-hosted a few weeks ago, said she looks like something that haunts Vera Farmiga in one of the Conjuring movies. And I have to tell you, you are clutching onto your seat when these scenes are happening. You cannot believe this is how they have decided to handle the childhood of Celine Dion, as if she was a little girl with the face of a much older person. It is mind-blowing. It reminds me a little bit of an old Oscar nominee from the 50s, Julie Harris, in an adaptation of The Member of the Wedding, a Carson McCullers book, is 29 playing a 12-year-old. But that has sort of a Broadway vibe to it in the way that, you know, who is it? Celia Keenan-Bolger plays like a little girl in the To Kill a Mockingbird on stage. Like, it feels somehow a little bit more justifiable. And there are no computers involved.
And her brother, Andrew Keenan-Bolger, is perpetually 12.
Yeah, he's a friend of mine. Looks like Mighty Max, if you remember Mighty Max.
Of course I remember Mighty Max. You know what? Actually, you know what that sounds like? It sounds like the Goosebumps book, The Haunted Mask.
Yes, right. What, anyway.
You're the old man mask on your face and then turning old.
Wow. Yeah, it's exactly like that. Just to let you know, I want you to see this movie because it's provocative enough and strange enough that it's worth viewing. But my God, I cannot believe the decision they made to illustrate her childhood that way. Also, problem with this movie, though, without the Rene Charles thing, Celine's life is largely drama free. Like, they try to make big scenes out of like filming famous album covers, you remember, and the fact that she's saying My Heart Will Go On at the Oscars, but that's not like, I don't know, it's not really worth encapsulating in a film. So I'm, as you can see, I have mixed feelings about this movie.
You know, I haven't really loved many French films since New Wave became Old Wave.
Great. Ira just tilted his beret at me as he said that.
You can read the rest of my takes in Cahiers du Cinéma.
Cahiers. I actually took 4 years of French. I should be criticizing you way more often. Ira, what is your keep it?
So my keep it this week involves the airlines.
Oh, sure.
Yeah. You know, Delta, I'm a Delta girl. United, American, Alaskan, and Southwest have now ended their mask mandates. And, of course, people have a lot to say about it. Here's my thing. Clearly, I'm not running around in a mask every day. You know, like, I didn't have one on a Coachella, except when I was protecting myself from the dirt and the dust of the desert. A plane? Honestly, I think I'm going to always wear a mask on a plane because they are disgusting.
It just feels right to have a mask on a plane, I have to say. Even though, like, I'm somebody who wants to luxuriate a little bit, I want to have a pleasant experience, there is just something of like, who the fuck is next to me? Like, this guy probably owns a macaw. I don't want to be near that.
Yeah, it's just when you remember how close you are to other people and you're thinking about what they did that day. Did they shower?
Yeah.
Did they brush their teeth? Are they covered with the blood of their spouse who they just hacked up and buried underneath the bed before they hopped on a plane?
Right.
You never know.
Hitchcock movies are often true. That's right.
Strangers on a Plane is what we're talking about here, okay?
And I don't Ooh, trust strangers.
Yeah. I don't trust More strangers. Plates. And I want to be protected.
You know what? I haven't really thought about it till right now, but I bet celebrities really are going to miss mask culture if it ever goes away. I mean,
they're going to keep wearing it.
Yeah, it's got has to have worked out for them.
Masks and like a hoodie, like sunglasses. Like you are basically just like invisible to the populace when you do that.
Right. No, a couple of years ago, I was on a plane and sitting across from me was Cherry Jones, and like I had to like clutch my heart, like, oh my God, there's Cherry Jones. I bet Cherry Jones would be really annoyed to find I was looking at her for most of that flight. So she would probably just prefer to keep a mask on.
A lot of people recognizing Cherry Jones on flights, Lewis.
I mean, but the particular way in which a freak like me would recognize a celebrity, you just don't want to be, you don't want to be in the crosshairs.
Actually, probably you and a lot of straight men recognize Cherry Jones on a plane. She was the president in 24.
No, I know that I would intersect with 24 culture does not feel like me. And also Succession, of course.
I loved 24.
That seems like you. I'm not surprised.
You know, it's also why I'm xenophobic.
Well, also, no, network television of the 2000s, it doesn't surprise me you were a viewer.
Also, you know, like, 24 was a show for men.
Sorry to laugh
for
in your
real
face.
Men. For yeah. real men, okay. You know? And
it's crazy
I love,
that I'm taking off the headphones and I'm walking away from the computer.
I love popping a brewski and watching Kiefer Sutherland torture terrorists.
Brewski, right, that's what men say. They definitely
in the
use
name
slang
of America.
From, they definitely use slang from Wayne's World still. Yeah, for sure.
Pop a cold one.
pork rinds. Yeah. All these male signifiers from like 1991.
You know what? Speaking of planes, you know what planes actually got me into recently? Slim Jims.
It's like been a long jerky. Time. Yeah, well, okay.
I never liked jerky at all. And then once the pandemic hit, every airline decided to stop their meal service and they gave us these shitty, like, American version of bento boxes, with like bad cheeses and jerky in them. So I just like start eating, you know, the brie with the jerky and turns out I like jerky.
Oh, I like strips of jerky. I the Slim Jim consistency, I feels like it's going to take my teeth out, but, like a turkey jerky, absolutely. Mind you, yeah. I'm like Salt Planet, period. So almost anything salty I love.
Yeah. So you know what? I like jerky like a real man.
Okay. Tell it to your shrink. Great.
Yeah. I'll tell it to my heart. A song that real men love because real men love Taylor Dane. She's one
Poor
hot babe.
Yeah.
She's one hot babe.
Yeah. No, I always say about Taylor Dane, she has the soul of a divorcee, but she's never been married, and that's talent.
What encapsulates the soul of a divorcee?
You're asking me? Just, you know, a sense of like...
Three-time divorcee Louis Vertel.
I just think it means you're free and unfettered and like, you know, a little angst-ridden and love, you know, just loving letting your rancor fly.
Uh-huh. You've definitely shouted about alimony. To a stranger before,
yeah.
Definitely, you know, like, destroyed the personal belongings of a man.
Well, I feel that I live that picture of Nicole Kidman leaving her last, meeting with Tom Cruise that led to their final divorce where she's exulting in the sun and probably getting like a ninth degree sunburn.
And your hair does look like that when you leave berries.
Oh, that's... Little red curly cues all over my face.
Anyway, that's our show this week.
That was a fun one. So you're not going to do Coachella weekend too, huh?
Absolutely not.
Okay.
I am old.
Right. You ever think about how we're old? Because we weren't when this podcast started, but now something has changed.
My back is... My back has like, is screaming like Freddy Krueger's back, like with the souls of all the children he's murdered. Right? And it's like, please lie down, Ira.
My neck, my back used to mean something different to us. And now it's just what we say when we go to the hospital.
All right, Kathy comic.
Don't drag Kathy into this. Kathy Guy's wife, we love you.
Do we love Kathy?
I think if Kathy didn't exist, there would be a real hole in the like legacy of comics and ladies therein.
That's fair. You know who's underrated as a woman in comic strips?
Go ahead.
That nosy bitch Mary Worth.
Oh yeah. No one ever talks about Mary Worth.
She is always in her neighbor's business. And I think more people should appreciate just like how saucy that comic strip is.
Yeah. Okay. Mary Worth, you got me thinking. I thought the first lady of comics was Lucy Van Pelt, but it might be Mary Worth.
Also, at this point, she is 600 years old.
No, there's no such thing as new comics. I can't imagine something like, oh, I have a new comic strip coming out.
All right. Thank you to Alexander Skarsgård for joining us. We will see you next week. Keep It is a Crooked Media production. Our senior producer is Kendra James. Our producer is Chris Lord. Our executive producers are Ira Madison III
and Louis Fertel.
Our editor is Charlotte Landis, and Kyle Steglin is our sound engineer.
Thank you to our digital team, Matt DeGroot, Nara Malkonian, and Delon Villanueva for production support every week.